yes. So let's start with this. So as our chair has rightly said, overarching questions have been emerging in our exploration of the deepest layers of the visible matter. So what we're going to talk about today is concerning the visible matter, right? So that 4% of matter in the pie charts that you all know. So one of the questions, one of the big questions is, how does a proton get its mass, okay? So we know that the intrinsic mass of the three valence quarks in the nucleon adds up to only about 2% of the total proton mass. The protons and neutrons account for nearly all mass of atoms, okay, so this is what we're made of, and that nearly all the mass of visible matter in the universe is due to mechanisms that are other than the Higgs mechanism. And so this is an important question, and as Albert says, you're living, you're quite busy, mass, you matter. So mass and matter, okay? This is what it's going to be about. So these mechanisms should be explained within the established and elegant and concise fundamental laws of quantum chromodynamics, which are summarized in the Lagrangian of QCD, which is written here, with its quark, okay, let's pay attention to this, we're going to talk about later, and its gluon component. However, the complexity, we all know that the complexity of the proton and neutron dynamics in terms of interacting quarks makes it one of the biggest challenges in physics today. So in some sense, we're in the same boat as those solid-state theorists, because we start from a Lagrangian that we know, but it's very, very complicated to solve, and a new phenomena emerge as we try to solve it. So, in order to get an idea here, let's start slowly, okay? So, the mass of the human body, let's look at ourselves as a visible matter, is we can sum it as the sum of all the masses of all the cells. So, in principle, we can count one by one the cells in our body, and count one by one the molecules in each cell, and you see that we can account for all of them, and that we can estimate the composition of, for instance, a human 70 kilograms male human body. I don't know why on the web this is the thing that comes up. we can account for all of them, and so we are mostly the largest part of molecules is hydrogen, and then comes oxygen and carbon, and here are all the atoms. We can account for each and every one of them, not missing any single one. And again, this is again the same concept, and now we have the percentage of mass, which is interesting, and the atomic percent. So of course the atomic percent, hydrogen wins, because for every oxygen atom in the water of our body, we have two hydrogens. Okay, and this is also, I think, I find an interesting piece of information. Okay, now let's go one layer deeper, the atomic nucleus. So we look at the atomic nucleus, and so you see that, so let's look at the carbon atom, for instance. You know that the total atomic mass is approximately 0.8% lighter than the individual particle that makes it up. And the 0.8%, although it looks like a tiny percentage, is important. It's what makes, you know, the nuclear plants there in Lake Anna work, okay? It's this enormous amount of energy, which is in the nuclear binding energy that we have learned to harness and to use otherwise. Let's leave that aside. Now, let's go one layer deeper. So if you go one layer deeper and you look at the nucleon, you just reverse the situation. So you reverse the situation and you see that the up and the down quark have masses of a few MeV, and the total proton mass and equivalently the neutron mass is almost one GeV, so 938 MeV. And so you reverse the situation. So 99.2 of the proton and neutron mass is in the interaction. And so how is this? So there's an enormous amount of energy in here, and how does this come about? So, exactly. So if this is the Lagrangian of QCD, we know that the mass that is generated by the Higgs mechanism, which is this mass that enters here, is just very, very minute. It's an itsy bitsy teeny tiny piece of the mass that makes our bodies and visible matter in general. And outside Earth. it is very far in value from the characteristic scale of the strongly interacting matter. And so this is my opinion here. We found the Higgs boson, we found it, but that's no God particle. Because the search, you know, for the search for what generates masses on, because we cannot account for most of the, for the other 98.8%, 0.2% of the mass of the universe. All right. So this is one fact. So now the other big mystery, and this is a mystery, okay? This is a mystery. It is something that we do not know how to solve as of yet. So how does the proton get its spin? You know, the quark-side protons spin 1/2. You know, that so there are three quarks, right, in the proton, U, U, D. And so naively, we expect that the proton spin is given by two quarks with spin 1/2, and one with spin minus 1/2. And so you expect to build the proton spin in this way. It's a little bit more complicated. We'll see it in a moment. And so the spin is carried by the extra quark. And so this should be very simple. However, there was this experimental upset in 1989 at CERN. So the measure intrinsic spin of the three valence quarks in the nucleon adds up to only 12% plus or minus 14%. It's almost zero of the total spin. This is the valence part. Okay? And so, and I will see a little bit how these experiments are done later on. So the gluons like photons, they have spin one. So they could contribute. So evidently, now the first thing that we think about is that the spin is in the gluons. Well, from recent experiments, we know that the spin of the gluons is relevant, okay, but it's not enough. As we will see later on also, we cannot quote exactly what the spin carried by the gluons is, because it's highly controversial, and so I am not I'm not an experimentalist myself, and I'm not going to stick up my neck and put a number there. However, what we know is that it's not enough, even with all the possible error bars in. And so more than 50% of the proton spin is also missing. And so can the orbital motion of the constituents, here I gave you an example of what a nucleus would be with all the spins and orbital motion, including the orbital motion of the quarks, make up for the missing dark spin? Where is the rest of the spin? This is here an example of the what we call the angular momentum budget. And the thing to take away from this chart, this is two ways to decompose the nucleon spin in terms of quarks and gluons and orbital motion. And so the part to take away from this graph is that this part up to here is what we know from measured experiments. And again, this delta G is a sketch of what is going on. And there's a large part that is unknown, however you decide to divide up the proton spin. Okay? So now, again, okay, we can start here looking at, you know, starting from the macroscopic and going down, you know, layers of matter. We don't have spin ourselves, okay? So we cannot start from the spin of the human body. Although, depends on the errands that I run. So we start from the spin of the atomic nucleus. And here comes the work of Maria Goppermeier, that here, let me take a parenthesis, and let me take a knee. And I'm taking a knee, and it should be serious. We should all do that, actually, because she's the last Nobel Prize to a woman in physics, the last one, 1963. And this is something that I'm also sensitive to, she worked without a job. All the work that was done there, she was not offered a job. In other words, all the work that was done that gave her the Nobel Prize didn't give her a job. So anyway, this was a genius. So she understood. So we understood in the nucleus, what was the theory is that you can do a shell model. You can do a shell model just as when you look at atoms. You wouldn't think that the nucleus inside the nucleus, this is such a dense system that they can be arranged in shells, okay? Like the electrons in the atom, they have these huge, like nice, airy orbitals, right? However, it does, you know, the shell model does apply, and we can make sense of these magic numbers that correspond to the doubly closed shell nuclei. And this overlapping here of some of the shells when we go to the upper levels, so when we add it, when we start piling up more and more nucleons, because of this spin orbit effect. And this is the thing she understood, the shell structure, and she understood this mechanism of the Spinorbit effect. And this is what gave her the Nobel Prize. And thanks to this scheme of Maria Goppelmeier, we can now understand the charge of nuclides, and we can understand it in fine detail, and we can now understand it in areas which are part of this new program, which is the F3 program in Michigan. So we are still, most of the program in Michigan is still starting from the work of Maria Goppelmeier. Okay, so we understand that. So once we have the shell structure, we can add up the spins of the nucleons, and then we know that the spin of the nucleus, in most cases, there are some exceptions that are interesting to study, but that's the other side. In most cases, it's going to be given by the spin of the upper shell. Okay, so we know how to build it up, to sum it up. There's a lot of spade work here. Okay, it's not straightforward, a lot of flexures, right? But we know how to do that. Now we go one layer deeper, and we look at the proton and neutron. So we look at the proton and neutron, and what happens? Again, I'm going to give you now that 1/2 plus 1/2 minus 1/2. So let's put all the quarks in an S orbit, and let's start as the first approximation to build up the spin of the proton and neutron as we would have done in a nucleus. That's like first order approximation, let's say. And so we see that in this case, it works out fine. But we have our wave function with the UU, the quarks with spin is an SU4. Technically speaking, wave function, and we know how to build up the spin, and we know that this spin has to add up to 1/2 this quantity, so it's going to be 1/2. The experiments, what did the experiments measure? The experiments that are done here, awesome, for the nuclear group here, we measure, we have polarized protons, and we measure the polarization of the quark, okay, inside the longitudinally polarized proton. And this is, again, this number. Okay, that we come up with. So we know how to get this precisely in the experiment, and precisely it is far away from our naive prediction. So, okay, also the C quarks and gluons are polarized. However, this is this is not gonna happen. Again, whatever we find, the findings are, we will never have enough that the G to give us the total spin. So that cannot, the gluons cannot account for the spin of the exactly. Does God play with spin? I was thinking it will be more for the pi divided. however, we don't know. So where's the nucleon spin? Okay. In order to answer these questions, we have to set up a theoretical scheme. Okay? So the theoretical scheme is quantum chromodynamics QCD. So what do we look at in QCD? We look at the energy momentum tensor. So we look at the energy momentum tensor and the angular momentum density, which is defined with the spatial coordinate. This is where space starts creeping in here, okay? So let's pay attention to this. So this is how the energy momentum tensor is. You know that this element is the energy density. Here is the momentum density on the sides, and then the shear stress and pressure here, okay? Or in a more familiar format, this way, all right? So we have pointing vector here, the shear stress, and the energy density in terms of the this will be the gluon field, right? Okay, the force carrier field. So this is an operator, technically, in QCD, and so if we want to find observables, if we want to go out and measure what's going on here, we have to sandwich this operator in between proton states. And so we can rewrite our energy momentum tensor knowing the Lagrangian of QCD straightforwardly in terms of quark and gluon terms. There are many interesting caveats here that I'm not going to get into now, but okay. So now we can have a closer look at the mass. So we look at the Hamiltonian in QCD, and it's going to be given by this this is sandwiched in between proton states, okay? The energy momentum tensor, and we can separate out into quark gluon energy terms and these other two terms. What are these other two terms? These other two terms come from a particular aspect of the QCD energy momentum tensor, and it's called the trace anomaly. And so we have a quark mass anomaly and a gluon anomaly that comes in. And this way of dividing the energy momentum tensor was suggested by Xiangnan Ji in 1995. It is not unique. Okay, But it's a way of looking at it. The quark energy and the gluon field energy are instead those quantities that we go out and measure in our high energy experimental physics laboratories. So recently there was this lattice calculation, the KQCD collaboration. So this is Keifei Liu and collaborators, okay, youngest post on the collaborator. And they did a calculation in lattice QCD, and they separated it out exactly in this way with the errors. And you see this XQ and XG are the ones that we can go out and measure in principle. And so this is given at a normalization scale in the detail. And this is just to give you an idea of where we're heading, okay, in here. Let's take a closer look at spin. We can divide it up equivalently. Now this is now the angular momentum density, okay? And there's this with some specific components that we'll get into. And so there is a quark spin. There is a quark term that looks like this and that we associate, that we call quark orbital angular momentum because of its shape. D is a covariant derivative. So it's like taking an R cross P, okay? Kind of thing, and sandwiching it into the proto states. And then we have the gluon angular momentum, and here we go again. Okay, so this involves the color fields. Okay, so the color fields, and it comes from that F mu tensor. Okay, QCD, and we know how to do this. Again, there are caveats here. This is one way that we can divide it into. Okay, and so now we look at the nuclear spin and lattice QCD. This was very recent paper by Dean Alexander and collaborators in the Cyprus collaboration, by the way. Okay. And again, Keifei Liu and collaborators. And in here you see this dashed and these four lines. They separate, this is a very important fact on the lattice, they separate the connected and the disconnected diagrams. And Keifei Liu collaborators claim that they can do the same. So we get an idea, we can calculate this quantity again with an error in lattice QCD. So we have an idea of where we're aiming at from lattice QCD, but this is theory. So the point that I would like to make from now on, and where the spatial and the momentum distributions come in, and the imaging comes in, and the tomography comes in, is that to understand both the mass spin and the orbital motion in particular, we need to be able to describe and measure both the space and momentum distributions of quarks and gluons. So we have to devise experiments that can help us measure both the space and momentum distribution. How do we do this? Well, before we go ahead and see how we do this, let me just give you an example of how it's important. Like for spin, this is like one of the images that is shown all the time in my field. So you look at, for instance, this is a proton that is polarized transversely up, and we're looking at the U quark distribution inside this proton. And if you polarize the proton transversely, the U quark distribution gets distorted because of the color field in the transverse plane, but in the opposite direction, 90 degrees. And so in order to understand this, we need to understand the spatial distribution. This is a spatial effect, okay? Again, the same thing for mass. Mass is even more scenic, more interesting, sorry. Well, look at the color charge flux field. This is, again, it's another result from lattice. This is the breaking of the flux field. It's interesting. Again, so you place these two charges, the two quark and anti-quark, difference, and you look at this, there's something here between them, and this something between them is this flux tube, and so there's the energy, okay, of the field in between the two charges, and then you can break them apart, okay, and then this is an observation. You can run this on the lattice, and you see that obviously the space in which these quark and the quark pairs are placed, okay. So, my question, I'm a phenomenologist, so I like to know and to devise experiments to look at this at this point. So how do we look at this in the lab? Now let's go and look at this in the lab. So what experiments can we devise? to test this dynamical picture, and how do we see inside the program? That's what we want to do eventually. So that's what I repeat. The students know. This is an experimental science after all. Okay. So okay. We cannot see structures at the atomic level because, you know, we're limited by the wavelength of visible light. So we cannot see it that way. Exclude the light. You're not gonna go see that, right? We can use electrons. So we can use a transmission electron microscope. And so by scattering electrons, they have a much smaller wavelength. This allows us to reconstruct pictures of microscopic particles. The other power for let's say gadget that has been built in recent years is the scanning probe microscope. So we monitor like this the tunneling current between the probe and the surface of a sample as a tip scans the surface. And I hope that this is an accurate enough but concise definition. And so now we can now image, thanks to these techniques, we can now image the structure of matter in 3D at the atomic level, at the atomic level. So that means down to 10 to the minus 10 meter at the atom level. And here I'm showing you, you know, some picture from Petra, actually, in which you can see, and maybe you'll comment better if I'm not sure that you go from this picture. This is the scale, 4.6 nanometers, so this is above the nanometer. Now this is 2 nanometers, and so you see that we are looking at the structure below the nanometer. So we are seeing the atoms, and to me it's like, wow. So okay. So now, how can this work for a relativistic system where all these components are moving nearly at the speed of light? I'll show you the big mess. So this is the problem. Okay, I can mimic it for you. So how can we do this? You know, we are really, 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 you know, our research is hampered by this issue. So we have to think. So this is what physicists are coming up with. This is the time that I'm working. So there's a new theory development. Some people like well, Jones, I'm gonna think this is not new. I know. So this is a Wigner phase-space distribution, however, it's at the femtoscale. Okay, so we're looking at Wigner, so it's the same idea, but at the femtoscale. Femtoscale means, you know, Fermi, so 10 to the minus 15 meters. So 5 orders of magnitude below what Petra does. And so Wigner space distributions are phase-space distributions, and so here I show you the double slit example. For instance, this is from atomic physics. So you see that you can have position in one axis, and you can have momentum on the other axis. Okay, you can have both. Okay, you will have to deal with the uncertainty principle. Yes, but this is something that we can set aside, and there are several ways to do it. And together, let's say, theory and experiment. The new experimental probe, it's a specific class of high energy scattering experiment, which is this one here. So we scatter an electron that exchanges a highly virtual photon, so a photon with a big four momentum, so this is relativity squared, with the proton that is sitting here, for instance, and we measure the outgoing proton and the and a radiated photon. Okay, so this is a deeply virtual experiment because of this photon, and it is exclusive. It is exclusive because I don't just shatter the whole thing. I just go and measure all of the products of the reaction, and this is what we call an exclusive reaction. So I measure the photon and the proton. Now we have to take a quick, in order to understand this relativistic issue, we have to take a quick ride on the light cone, which is going to be fun. So this is the light cone, okay? We've seen it many times, I think. This is how we write on the light cone, the variables that are the matter are this combination of energy and longitudinal momentum. The plus and minus components. And so for a particle with larger momentum in the longitudinal direction, limited transfer momentum, we have that P plus is gonna be large and P minus is gonna be small, okay? Because we subtracted. So when we do the Fourier transform, which is gonna matter when we do imaging, we have that P plus is conjugate to Z minus, where Z minus is our distance, and P minus is conjugate to Z plus, and the transverse part is on its own. And this is for the fans of Dr. Seuss, which is my generation, not even my kids. So it is three torpedoes, okay? In case you want a precise quote, okay? So this is how the proto-relativistic wave function looks like, and so we're going to use Poincaré invariance and explain it in a moment. So this is P plus. Now we know what P plus is. This guy is zooming like boom, like that in the lab. This is the transverse distance of all the quarks in there. Every quark takes a fraction x of the initial momentum. We define a center of momentum. Okay, the center of momentum is defined exactly on the transverse plane. Is defined exactly as the center of mass that you're used to in your non-relativistic mechanics for a good reason. So the mass, the role of mass, is played by this fraction, xp plus. This is going to play the role of mass. It's okay with everybody. All right. So p plus plays the role of mass. And so now the step here is that the way we phrase it in theory is that the subgroup of the Poincaré group that leaves the surface z plus equal constant invariant is isomorphic to the Galilean group in two dimensions. So what does this mean in plain words? This means that we can disentangle the transverse components or the time components in boosts. And so the boosts in the transverse plane are kinematical. And so that makes relativity difficult to deal with is absent in the transverse plane. Exactly absent. So this is the main realization. It's a simple concept, if you wish, but now, you know, this simple concept allows us to map out faithfully and or rigorously the spatial quark distributions in the transverse plane. So there's no modeling or approximation. And this is something that was pointed out by Soper, who is one of the founders of QCD, let's say, a long time ago, and then picked up by Matthias Burkhardt later on. And so we can form these distributions. There are distributions in x, in the longitudinal momentum of the quarks, the mass, and the transverse. So these are our, or a subset, okay, of the Wigner distributions. These are our Wigner, yes.
You mean transverse position.
Transverse position, yes.
Yeah. You said transverse moment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant that it was a slip of the tongue. It was a slip of the tongue. Thank you. Longitudinal momentum fraction and transverse position, Wigner. Okay, thanks. So good. So this was the ride on the light cone. Now let's go and look at deep inelastic scattering experiments. So what do deep inelastic scattering experiments measure? Deep inelastic scattering experiments measure this proton wave function as a scatter off a virtual photon of it. As it transitions, so we look at the quark distribution, as they transition from a position, and this is what we call a light QCD, quark in space, a position of Z minor in space on the light cone, to zero. Okay, so this is what we measure in deep inelastic scattering experiments along the light cone. And so Z minus, as we said before, is conjugate to P plus, and so it's conjugate to X. So by measuring this correlation function, we access the Parton distribution functions, which is this Q sub x, which is, however, and we have, however, no understanding whatsoever about the transverse distances. They don't come into play, simple, okay? And this, we mapped it out. This is what was, you know, considered the work of QCD, or perturbative QCD. And these are the quantities that are, one of the major components of the at the LHC. Okay, see this. So from deep elastic scattering, now we can look at elastic scattering. And so in elastic scattering, we have only one photon is exchanged. So the proton is scatters elastically by exchanging one virtual photon, ep to ep prime, e prime p prime. And you see, so we measure the nuclear form factor. And so now, my words. In a non-relativistic approximation, this is what the nuclear form factor looks like. All right. And so we access a spatial component, which, however, now has the transverse, but it also has a longitudinal component. in by looking at the form factor, we cannot sort of get rid of the longitudinal component. Now, this is the new generation of experiments that is designed at Jefferson Lab. And you see that this is EP into E prime gamma P prime. So we measure an outgoing photon and an outgoing proton. And now they measure this type of correlation function, in which we measure, yes, the deep and elastic part, because these are deep universal experiments, and we also measure a momentum transfer between the initial and the final proton, so they are, in some sense, the best of both worlds, okay? So they're both deep and elastic, and they measure this momentum transfer. I should say deeply virtual. So delta T is the conjugate of B, delta, the momentum transfer here, is the conjugate to B. And xv plus, as we said before, again, I repeat it, is the conjugate to z minus. So we have access to both. And this is where we get our distribution from. So we can access this distribution experimentally. This is what the purpose of this class was. So now, in summary, what have we learned? And then we're going to go a little bit deeper into this. So knowing the longitudinal Lyko momentum dependence allows us to separate out the transverse plane where Poincaré invariance applies. And then we can scan the transverse plane by measuring the scattered photon and proton with the momentum transfer delta. So we are all set up to take these measurements. So we are all geared up there. At Jefferson Lab, we have a lot of things going on. But what is it? Still, there's a problem. Well, actually, let me tell you, this is one thing. This is an interesting outcome that was initially sent out by Jerry Miller, this paper in 2007, and he noticed that now, there are surprises here. You look at the charge density. This is the proton charge density in the transverse plane. This is the neutron charge density in the transverse plane. So this is the rigorous one. This is the textbook one that was obtained in that approximation from the form factor in which we threw in there the longitudinal component. And by now, if you pay attention to what I said before, you know that the longitudinal component is the one that makes that doesn't allow us to have the canonical boost, so the one that messes up the relativistic aspect, okay, of this thing. And so you see that this is just a it's shattering result. It should be given more, you know, it has been given a lot of importance. I think this wasn't the New York Times, but just on so it is important. And this shatters our notion that the neutron is a sort of like a proton surrounded by a negative iron cloud. No longer. Okay? So, let's see if this goes away on its own, because I don't see it here. Let's see if it goes away on its own. So, how do we look at this in experiments? Later. All right. So we start from Rutherford type experiments. So we know that this is, you know, what tells us that, you know, the type of experiment with this distribution by scattering alpha particles off the nucleus and looking at the type of distribution. It goes like 1 over sine 4 theta halves. We know that there's a point-like particle in the middle there. And hey, this is important for imaging, because if you think about it, this image that is everywhere now, you know, this is an atom everywhere in the world. Every child knows this, comes from that, okay? Think about it, the power of images. And so now we look at classical electron-proton deep galaxy scattering experiment. This is a HERA experiment, for instance. And so you see that the electron comes in similarly to the Rutherford scattering. Out comes a jet of particles, all kinds of particles here, but we measure the final electron in this calorimeter. And similarly, okay, we can reconstruct. We know when the scale of this interaction is smaller than the characteristic hadronic scale, so when this is deeply virtual, we know that we can resolve the nucleus substructure differently from Rutherford. There is this, so the proton shatters in gazillions of pieces, okay? And these gazillions of pieces have an invariant mass that is very, very large. and it can be produced, it can be very, very large, because this Q-square is very, very large, so we just shatter them at the speed of light, and so these particles hadronize, okay, the direct detector for many, many other particles. And so this is what we would have in a Rutherford scattering experiment, and instead you have a distribution in X, which turns out to be related to the invariant mass. So that same X that gave us the momentum fraction turns out to be related to the invariant mass. And so you see that you obtain this bumps that are the quark distributions. Again, the scattering. So then you do the electromagnetic form factors. Again, we repeat again the elastic scattering a little bit deeper, okay? And yes, many of my experimental colleagues have been experts, world experts on these. And so the one thing to take away from this picture, well, here is the electron scatters through exchanging a virtual photon. The proton is sitting here, it's kind of sitting right here, and then it scatters off, you know, at an angle, phi, with respect to the electron plane. And so the thing to take away here is that these form factors decrease with the momentum transfer. So that means that the higher the momentum transfer, the more energetic the momentum transfer, the less the likelihood that this particle will scatter as a whole, okay? So it means it will most likely undergo the other type of experiments. So in deeply virtual quantum scattering, we have the two. So we scatter similarly to the elastic scattering, we have a virtual photon here. But now we are gonna measure this photon and this proton. And that's what allows us to access these Wigner distributions, or a subset of Wigner distributions, which are called the generalized quantum distributions. There are a host of experiments that have been set up at Jefferson Lab. I'm showing you the solid detector, because it's the one that had that message drawing. Okay, and so here's the electron coming in, scatter the target, you measure the electron. This is a pion, it could be a photon, it could be any other colors of reaction here. And so you get these, you can map out these Wigner distributions, or in this case, the generalized quantum distribution. All right, this is how the data look like. So now, out of all these data sets, this is a painstaking, so this is the point. We want to form images here. Now, I wanted to, you know, give this idea, this concept, that we want to form images here. And so it is a painstaking process. So we take gazillions of data that have, they depend on many kinematical variables, some of them we saw them, the Q squared, the X, which is the invariant mass, the momentum transfer, which is this delta T squared, and as a function of the angle phi. So this is painstaking, okay? What we've been able to do so far with traditional type of analysis is, and this is a proof of concept, it's an important result, is, was done by Raphael Dupré and collaborators, is we can map out the radius of the quark matter as a function of Bjork and X. And so they, with these large error bars, so their claim is that the radius is decreasing with X. This is what comes out of their fits. I leave it to you, okay? it's very tough to talk to these guys because they're believers, okay? But at the same time, this is interesting.
Yeah, right.
This is interesting because this is the proof of concept. This is a very important first result that will be shown over and over and over again. This shows that we can map it. We can map it. We can do that. Okay. So theorists can play then. Okay, and that's what we do with ABBA all the time. So we can then now map, see how the shrinking of the proton with X. So we can show these things. These are model based. Okay, by the way, they're not just drawings. They're model based. So there's QCD modeling in there. And then we can look at the charge density of the neutron versus X and see what gives what gives the negative charge in the middle, what type of how this varies with X, that it starts out, if you have a bigger radius, it is negative, and then it there's a mixture of positive and negative charge. You know that there are DA Newports in there, and then the positive charge comes up, but in average it's all going to be negative in the center. So we can start, you know, looking at doing studies of this type, okay, that I'm not going to bore you with. And the point here is that in the project that we're on with Dustin and Sandy Myers, an undergraduate, and Lydia to join recently, is that we need a new generation of analysis. So we need to really start working, like perfectioning our computer science algorithms and approach. We need to start interacting with computer scientists as it was in the old-fashioned days, that, you know, the physics and math go together. Now it's moving more and more and more, and we would like the computer scientists to come in and interact with us on what you know, techniques are needed to extract this information from the data in the fastest way. And you need to know the phenomenology for this. So there's interdisciplinary groups to be formed here. Okay. So, last 10 minutes. So, what have we learned? Okay. So this is, I have to show a little bit what I've been doing here. So I hope, okay. And what can we still learn? So, well, I started out with the angular momentum density is one. This is what keeps me going. Then the energy density, the shear stress. Okay, we looked at these things. Let me just go over this again. And so, Bartonic orbital angular momentum is described by a Wigner distribution, okay, in the transverse plane. That's sort of like obvious, okay? And so we like to have access to the angular momentum subrule. This is a byproduct of these imaging studies, okay, which has a lot of theory in it in the meantime, so it keeps us busy while we are waiting for or thinking of how to work on the images. So we get this quantity from a beam target spin correlation, which is a polarized quark density in a longitudinally polarized proton. And so we need these guys sitting here to do the experiments. And so you can describe this in terms of generalized of different sets of generalized Martin distributions, and we have identified the ones that enter in this summary. And this is something that we, Abba and I, and our Lattice community colleague did. And so this, we get it from DVCS. This has been figured out by G. This was the new term that we have been working on. That's the polarized scattering experiments. And that's the coral force of the gauge link that we also introduced. And then, so this is an interesting plot, I think, that summarizes our findings. This, the total angular momentum. So in order to know, you know, what carries the spin, we can plot the total angular momentum, and I'm taking the U minus D component because that's the easiest one, versus this is J versus L, okay? So J versus L meets the zero axis at this value here, delta sigma divided by 2. Okay, which is known experimentally to high precision. That's like the axial form factor that Stefan has. So it's here. This is the error bar. It's tiny. Experiments at Jefferson Lab, at the same way that we could plot that B, you know, with the big error bars, we could try to plot the J with big error bars. And this is on the top of that. It's controversial, but it's out there in a PIN. Okay, so I feel like I can publish actually this graph, and then there is L. So we need to understand to measure that generalized Parton distribution function to get L. So we need to measure the correlation function that I was showing before. And you can get it out from Lattice QCD, in fact, in this paper by Michael Egg, I don't know what his name is. So So now we are. Let me just go here. So we know that the delta sigma, the L, and the J all match here, and so we are okay. So we think that the spin sum rule, at least in the Poisson sector, is satisfied. But we don't know, because suppose that we decrease the error in J. So this is easy to have everything match in this plane, because we don't know things with a sufficient accuracy. So what we want to do, oh God, I mean, oh no. Okay.
I recognize him.
This is a nightmare. This is a realization. Okay. Okay. So, I don't know why. So then we can look at other correlations. We can look at the spin orbit correlations. They're interesting just as well. This is all new. There is a lot here. There are many, many interesting aspects here. There's a chiral symmetry breaking term here that is interesting. What Brad has been busy with, which is we can look at the color forces at the three level. We want to look at these gauge links. And then we look at nuclei. So that there is this, DBCS has been looked at in nuclei, and nuclei are very important now. They're very important. It is important to look at the structure of neutrons in nuclei. And we looked at the structure of the deuteron, for instance. So we have a sum rule for the angular momentum in the deuteron that we should write an experimental proposal on, because this, I think, should be measured. We need the transversely polarized target, and I think we have it here for the deuteron. Do we? Yeah. Okay. so okay. And then the unpolarized, so the nuclei unpolarized sector. This is so important to reinterpret because of this finding that the neutron density is so different when we look at it from. The GPD, the general spectral distribution, the Wigner distribution point of view, when we looked at it that way, because of this thing, this will have unprecedented consequences on nuclear density distributions. And this is from silicon 34. This is the nuclear density that shows this kind of bubble formation to the neutron stars. So this impacts directly the neutron stars. So this is where I think it's interesting, and this is why we're working so hard to get that. Yeah. And then finally the energy density. This happens to be a technical term at this 3GPD, and we are interested in that. It's connection with the tensor interaction, which is also interesting. And in the end, scalar. This is the scalar interaction right here. You see, I'm psi bar psi, and tensor interactions together are those terms that impact the BSM searches, and that's where we wrote this paper with Stefan. Okay. So, and finally the shear stress. This is almost unexplored. We did this back then with Sadin for helium 4, and now that we can access this in experiments, this is also going to be interesting. This was just like a shopping list just to snow everybody, as it's supposed to be at the end of the colloquium. And I would like to conclude, this is my conclusion, with and in any case, I went very fast on that purposely because I don't like to show off. But if you have any question on any of the slides before, I'll linger on them. All right, a little bit more. And so I'd like to end with a sentence by Maxim Polyakov, who was one of the players in this game. He is a professor at Boku University. And then hopefully, and I love this sentence in his paper. Hopefully, experimental studies of the hard exclusive processes, which are the hard exclusive processes, but it's deeply virtual exclusive processes, will fill the gap in our understanding of the strong force creating our world as we see it. Okay? So yeah.